know in Anchorage, Alaska?
Anyone else?
Well, hearing nobody else, let's move on to approval of agenda and minutes from our last meeting. Anybody want to make a motion?
I'll make a motion to approve. This is Devin. I'll make a motion to approve the agenda.
Second. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll move on to public comments.
Is there any callers want to make comments?
Comments? Okay, hearing no public comment, John, it looks like your commissioner's update here, so.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're moving right through the agenda really quick. Yeah, we had, Dan had sent out an email a while back and Tara had for any agenda items, and a lot of those that came through fit more into the area of you know, an update on the status of a number of things as opposed to an item that we would have on the agenda for discussion and action. And have six items on there, and want to start off first with the GO bond bill in the legislature. There are actually one bond bill, one in the House, one in the Senate, HB 93, SB 74, and actually as we were speaking right now, as I'm speaking right now, House Finance is convening and they're taking up discussion of HB 93, the bond bill there. You know, there's a lot of questions about the bond bill, where the projects came from. You know, and there's some concerns that it doesn't meet the single subject requirement of legislation. But regardless, the intent of the bond bill, the governor in October wanted to have a bond bill, a projects bill, a jobs bill to get some jobs going. And we gave him a list of shovel-ready projects, and then he threw something in there for most of the other departments in there. DNR had a lot, and some other departments had some in there. As far as comments on the bill goes, you know, there's not a lot of enthusiasm right now among some of the leadership for a bond bill. On one hand, money's really cheap. At least 2 months ago, the interest rate was really low and money's cheap, and there was a justification where we should be borrowing and taking care of some of the project needs that we have out there. And on the other hand, talking to some of the legislators, money is cheap, but there's also a big flood of federal money that has come through. CARES Act took care of a lot of problems we had. We had CRISA, and I'm talking an acronym here. CRISA that passed in late December had a lot of money for the state in there. In fact, Department of Transportation received through Federal Highway Administration about $124 million. We still haven't determined how that money is going to be, how the money's going to be spent. In fact, the legislature right now, finance committees are looking at that and trying to determine the best way to spend that. The federal highway funds, that $125 million, was intended to be capital funds, go into construction projects, although there is a little window of opportunity in the legislation that, if necessary, it allows us to use some or all of it for operating costs. But right now, and Ben, give me a dirty look if I'm saying the wrong thing, okay? Right now, the legislators and we are looking at various options on what to do with that $124 million. And like I said, it was intended to be capital money, and I think there's no shortage of capital needs out there for that. It would come as straight tied to 23. We don't get to spend it like state funds. So it has to go through the federal highway program. few strings attached like most federal funds are, but it's an opportunity to take care of some projects that we have on the list, as well as commit some of it to a deferred maintenance program, which we sorely need some deferred maintenance in there, and a few other things. But anyway, back onto the bond bill. You know, the leadership that we've talked to, again, some like the idea of a bond bill because of the cost of money, but some other ones are saying something along the lines that we have all this federal money, so why do we need to take on some debt? Did anyone have any questions from what I said on the bond bill?
I do, John. I was wondering, did you say that $124 million to DOT came through FHWA, but it's part of the CARES Act?
No, it's part of round two of the CARES Act, Tony, called CRISA. You know, they couldn't just do a CARES Act too. They had to give it another acronym back in Washington, D.C. And CRISA passed late December at some point. I don't know the exact date. And it included that FHWA funds of roughly $124 million. CARES Act didn't include any money through FHWA. There was a big slug that came through FAA, Federal Aviation Administration, big slug that came through Federal Transit Administration, but nothing through Federal Highway Administration in the CARES Act. And CARES Act was just a little bit over a year ago when it passed.
Thank you.
John, can
John, I have a question.
Go ahead, Donna, sorry.
Oh, sorry. I thought that FAA funds didn't require a non-federal share in 2020.
You thought the FAA funds?
Did not require a federal a non-federal share in 2020.
Yeah, no, that's correct. The FAA funds, two things happened, and that was in CARES Act. Okay, that passed a year ago. There were a couple of things that happened in that. We got a slug of money from the FAA that we could use essentially for maintenance and operations to replace revenue that aviation industry, airports, and that didn't get because of the significant drop in traffic with COVID. And that was really from our perspective, that was really good money. We could basically use it and turn it into GF, and it had a long life, so we could carry it forward for a couple of years. But also with that CARES Act, the FAA funds, at least for last fiscal year and the fiscal year we're in, had no match requirement. So their regular program was basically 100% money. We did not have to match it. And I believe that saved us on the order of $11 million, money that we had appropriated and set aside for match for those FAA projects.
So why do the bond projects have airport projects that require matching them?
I don't know, Donna. You know, as I've explained to a couple of people, back in October, we gave we provided a list of projects that were, quote, shovel ready. And it looks like that list of projects were put into a blender and something else came out on the other side. You know, so bond money is essentially general funds. It's state funds. It doesn't have federal strings attached, and it's very flexible in that regard. So I'm not sure whether the money for those projects was intended to be match or whether it was intended to supplant or supplement federal funds. Because many of the projects on that bond list, the original HB 93 or SB 74, were projects that were shovel ready. Many of them were. Some of them were, you know, we're still shrugging our shoulders.
Right, so I don't think that this bond project list is ready for prime time. I mean, it just seems to me like there's some flaws in how these list was developed. Like,
yeah.
Like, why is there a $6 million Convention and Visitors Bureau building in a project that's called the Fairbanks Seward Trail? it just doesn't make sense to me.
And Donna, you're not alone in that regard. Okay. The bond bill, the bond bill is undergoing a lot of work. And like I said, I don't even know if it's going to survive this year, past this year. And here's something interesting about bond bills. We had bond bills in 2002, 2008, 2012, okay, GO bonds. Prior to 2002, there was 20 years that we didn't have any bond bills because there was enough oil money paying for all our capital needs. But in 2002, they had a bond issue out there, both some facilities bond issue and some transportation bonds. And, it was interesting mix of projects on there, but they were all done in even calendar years because it's in even calendar years that you have statewide elections. And so to put one out now, 20 months ahead of a statewide election is kind of unusual.
So I just think that the non-federal share needs to remain a line item in our budget every year, and we cannot be trying to look toward GO bonds to cover our matching requirements for the federal dollar. And I'd hate to see that line be deleted from our annual budgeting exercise.
But you're not alone in that belief, Donna. I believe that the match for next year's federal funds is not intended to come from this bond bill, but there's actually AHFC has got a bill there that allows them to bond for the state match for federal projects. It's not through this GO bond, and it's a budget. A budget maneuver that's being done, and my sense is from listening to some of the finance committee's discussions is they may not do it that way. This is just what the administration proposed in their budget.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. Thank you.
You might want to talk to your legislators and let them know that.
Okay.
Donna, this is Tony.
Go ahead, Tony.
I was just going to say that I talked to some of the people on the Finance Committee in the Senate. It didn't sound to me like they were going to buy into that idea. They're going to require that it be budgeted as through a straight regular state budget process, the match.
Yeah, and I've heard that discussion too from probably some of the same people you talk to. So, yeah,
John, this is Aves. You was talking about the CRISA $124 million. You mentioned you had a list for earlier legislation. Do you have a list for this the distribution of this $124 million?
We've tossed a couple of ideas, a couple of options out to OMB on here's ways that we would recommend allocating these funds. And, I don't know what OMB has done with it, but I do know that a couple of finance committees or subcommittees, right now our budgets are in subcommittees, or at least our operating budgets are, and they're ready to go to the finance floor. And this is something that somebody else is going to be making that decision. Let me put it that way. And how it gets allocated between what capital projects.
John, I'm just wondering if there might be some way that we can contribute to the discussion about how that money is spent.
Certainly is. A number of ways you can do it. And, there's individual contact of your own legislators is one effective way.
Okay.
May I ask a question? This is Beth.
Yeah, Beth, go ahead.
Thank you. Commissioner McKinnon, through the chair, do you think that, have you bumped up your service on road maintenance after snowstorms? Because if you do have that extra money in CARES, I've noticed that the roads have been very clear out here, and I am not complaining. But I do know that even last year, there were several accidents due to heavy snow on the Glen Highway. And I don't know if that adjustment in prioritizing snow stuff was made 5 years ago, maybe. And I don't even know if you've updated it. So can you address that issue for me, please?
Yeah, that's actually D, fourth item down on the list, and I could talk about that now. Starting about six or seven years ago, when the price of oil tanked, we faced some very serious budget cuts in this department. And, you know, we've got a big budget. We're a big department, but most of our budget is federal funds and the ability to use those federal funds to as part of our operating program. And so it doesn't do any good to cut federal funds out of the budget. It makes the number look smaller, but it's really a kind of a moot cut. And so the cuts were made in our general fund support, largely in what's called our highway and aviation division. I call it our maintenance and operation because it maintains the 5,000 plus miles of road we have and the 237 airports that we own statewide. A lot of those airports are on the road system, so the same crew that maintains the road will also maintain the airport, and a lot of those airports are completely disconnected from our road system in a lot of the rural villages we have. And many of them, I believe about 140 of them are maintained by local contractors. We put contract bids out. So we've seen over the last 7 years a significant decline in our operating budget for the maintenance of our roads and airports, to the point where we've had to close five maintenance stations and turn one into a seasonal maintenance station. And that came to a head this year, Beth, when this year has been a very heavy snowfall year in many parts of the state. Not everywhere, it's not uniform. There are some places that have been just hammered with the snow and some places that haven't been hit that hard. And as a result of some snow that was happening, heavy snow happening in December, in Turnagain Pass between Anchorage and the Kenai Peninsula, we had snow conditions there and winter conditions there that we hadn't experienced since 1983. We were setting records that had previously been set in 1983. And we were directed to reopen the Silvertip Maintenance Station, and at the same time we reopened Chitna Maintenance Station on the Richardson Highway and Birch Lake as you get closer to Fairbanks on the Richardson. And, you know, it has made a big difference reopening those two. And we were able to do it because we had some CARES funds left over, not left over. We had the access to some CARES funds, and we used that to pay for the additional maintenance that we needed on those roads. You know, the governor has taken are very seriously the importance of road maintenance and highway safety, and that was a large part which led us to reopen those maintenance stations. Prior to that, we didn't have the funds to do it. You know, it's you have a budget, and you're given so much money, and you can't spend money you don't have, unlike some government entities can. And to give you a little bit further, and this kind of ties into I talked about earlier of some of the budget things they do. One of the things the legislature has done to DOT, instead of giving us general funds to support our maintenance operations, they said, okay, we're going to give you motor fuel tax revenue straight from the motor fuel tax receipts straight to DOT. Normally, motor fuel tax revenue would go into the general fund and then come to us as general fund dollars. If they gave us straight motor fuel tax revenue, what that shows in the overall budget picture is a cut of $40 million in general fund support for government. It's kind of smoke and mirrors there. Well, there's some interesting things that have happened with motor fuel tax over the last, it's been continuous, not just the last few years. But as vehicles get more and more efficient, we get hybrid vehicles on the road, we get electric vehicles. There are over 200 electric vehicles in the state right now, and the number of electric cars continues to grow. And what happens, and what's happened over the years, is as vehicles get more and more efficient, they use less gasoline. And I'll just pick on gasoline, not diesel. As a result, the state gets less motor fuel tax revenue. So giving us $40 million in motor fuel tax revenue for our maintenance and operation when we only actually realize $35 million because of efficient vehicles is like giving us Canadian dollars to spend to use for our budget. You know, once you do the conversion, you don't have what you were given in the first place. And what happened last year, to make matters even worse, with COVID happening and things tightening up and locking down, we saw about a 15% reduction overall in the amount of driving that people were doing. So 15% fewer cars on the road, 15% fewer miles driven means 15% less revenue that comes in from that source. So we were able to take the CARES money that came in last summer and apply it to some additional badly needed highway maintenance in the winter. So that might help explain some of the good snow removal you saw, Beth.
Yes, you explained it. Thank you.
Okay. Next item on the list was back on the maintenance restoration. You know, I think the legislature has realized that they can't continue to cut our maintenance and operation budget. You know, and they can't sit there and give us, you know, motor fuel tax revenue when that money's not going to be realized. And so, with a combination of both Silvertip, Birch Lake, Chitna, those maintenance stations reopening, plus some really tough weather in other parts of the state. I mean, this has been an extreme winter in many places. I know in Fairbanks, you guys have been hit a number of times up there. And, you know, in fact, I think just yesterday I got an email from Ryan Anderson saying that you guys, some part of the region up there was going to get another load of snow. How hard do we hit it? You know, we're getting close to spring, but it's not there yet. This is kind of like one of those Energizer bunny winters. You know, it keeps going and going and going. And Sunday in Juneau here, it was sunny and warm, and you could go out for a walk in tennis shoes. And yesterday, it was snowing sideways. Winter's not quitting yet. You know, so Ryan asked about the snow removal, and I said, you know, you got to hit it just like you would any other time of the year. And if that means we run short on budget and have to delay some of the road openings, you know, we delay them a little bit.
You got a question, Donna? I saw your hand up.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. On the CRISA funds, when do they have to be obligated is the first question. And then I also like Abe's idea of maybe this group can maybe look at some of these lists that you're developing for that funding, and just as a place to vet those lists.
You know, we don't have authority to spend CRISA yet. The legislature has to give us the authority. And so we can have our pockets full of money, but unless we have the authority to spend it, we can't spend it. CRISA funds have a 4-year life to them, I believe. And what the legislature is doing right now, and it'll probably be done as part of the capital budget, is determine how those funds are going to be spent. And again, CRISA for federal highways was intended to be capital. Yeah, but there is a window there that allows you to use it if needed on operating costs.
John, is there any opportunity to motivate the state to get this $124 million out sooner than later from a perspective of you had a $300 million bond package, this is about, you know, more than a third of that. If you use it on construction, it kind of offsets about a third of that package, I'd say.
You know, it certainly would, Dan. But you know, we've mentioned to a number of those people in position, and that we can, the money could always go into some good construction projects. And again, we also want to reserve some of it for some deferred maintenance side of things, because definitely some needs out there. This will be all part of the legislature's appropriation process and the budgets they're putting together. You know, meanwhile, we still have our normal federal highway program that's happening. So we're trying to get our M&O budget restored as best as we can. But I'll let you know that you know, it's not just a matter of putting money back into the thing. We still have issues with recruiting workers, retaining workers, and you know, there's some fundamental problems that we have. You know, we pay about $4 or $5 less than local governments, so we can get somebody from Scott's sister agency, Local 71, and put them to work and train them for a couple of years, and then they grab their 401k, their Tier 4 pension, and walk and go to work for the municipality of Anchorage for $4 or $5 more. It's a challenge. It really is. Mm-hmm. You know, last year I get to sign when somebody retires. A genuine retirement, not quitting. I get to sign a nice letter about them and their retirement letter. And man, I almost got writer's cramp last year for the number of people that retired in Northern Region, Central Region, after 25 and 30 years of working for the state in M&O. You know, that's a big loss of skilled workers there. You know, there must have been 20 or 25 that retired. That was a lot of them.
Thanks, John. Andrew, you got a question for us? I saw your hands up there.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Talking about maintenance and the lack of funds for maintenance, there was an article in the Anchorage papers over 20 years ago, but I always remember it. But anyway, in that article, one of the dock workers mentioned the change in the formula for paving. And I guess that change in the formula came about when Alaska started rolling in money, and there was a lot more money to be spending on maintaining existing roads, so that the roads that we have kind of quickly run out fast today, you know, so they have to be replenished or maintained more often. But prior to that, they had used a formula that didn't require that wear down the roads as fast. So there wasn't a need for maintenance funds that often. I think we should get back to that formula or something kind of, instead of using the formula that we used to spend up for to continually maintain no roads in Alaska. So that's something that I would like to see happen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Andrew.
So the next item on the update, CMGC procurement legislation. You know, our statutes allow us to get construction contracts underway two ways. One is the traditional design bid build, where we put it out to bid for a low to the low bidder, and the other one is design build. We have it in statute to allow design build, but for the last 20 years or so in the vertical work in building construction, we've been using a method called CMGC, Construction Manager General Contractor, where you know, the department brings a design consultant on and then puts out an RFP for a contractor, the most qualified contractor, to work with a design consultant in putting the design together and continually preparing estimates for the cost of the work and working on constructability issues and a variety of things. But you've got the contractor and the design team working together to get the project ready to go to construction. And at one point in the CMGC process, the contractor is prepares the estimate, and the owner, DOT, says, can you build it for the money that you say you can? And if the contractor agrees, you sign a construction contract. You know, it. One of the things that CMGC does in building work is it really helps with constructability. It keeps costs and change orders in line in the construction, and it gets the project delivered quicker. And when I say it keeps costs in line, when you sign a CMGC contract, the contractor does, that's the guaranteed maximum price that project's going to cost. Whereas when you do the traditional design bid build, where the consultant does the whole design there without a lot of input from contractors, and then we put it out for competitive bid, the price we get, that low bid we get, is the guaranteed minimum cost that project will cost. So there's a real benefit because it keeps costs in line. The real benefit to CMGC, it keeps costs in line and it delivers the project faster, because you don't have to quite design quite to the detail that you do to go out to a competitive bid. Well, we have done CMGC in the building side, but we have to go through a special process to get approval for it. It's under innovative procurement, and we've got to get the Attorney General to write up a justification for it, and it takes a little bit of an effort. And every time we do this, each CMGC contract is a one-off. It's unique. And what we proposed last fall, was we take CMGC contracting and we get it in statute so that it's much easier for us to do. And I know that we've done probably a half a dozen highway projects, civil projects under CMGC. I know Tony Johansson in Great Northwest has worked on a couple of those. In fact, they're doing one right now. Isn't University Avenue CMGC, Tony?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So we have a bill. It hasn't surfaced yet. We started on it last fall with a number of draft opportunities in there. It's gone through a couple of iterations, and you know, our contracts attorneys, you know, want a bill, want a law written one way, and attorneys in the legislative drafting side like to have it written another way. So we finally got agreement on how it needs to be written, and we're just waiting for the bill to be introduced. But CMGC has got a lot of opportunities. I believe it's got a lot of benefits to both the state and the construction community. You know, probably one of the biggest benefits in the whole thing is that it allows us to deliver projects faster. And, you know, when I came back to DOT a little over 2 years ago, I was briefed on the projects that were on the boards, you know, people were working on, and a lot of those same projects that we were working on 2 years ago, we were working on when I was a deputy commissioner here between 2003 and 2008. And, you know, I just kind of go, why does it take us so long to deliver these projects? And the biggest justification for going with CMGC, other than keeping costs in line, is it allows us to deliver them quicker, because we're in the business of providing transportation improvements to the public. And when that transportation improvement, when that project is still sitting on the drawing boards, the public's getting no benefit from it. The public gets the benefit from those projects when they're completed and they get to drive through the new intersection or on the fresh pavement or the interchange or whatever the improvement is. So our goal is to deliver these projects faster. Ben White's my program development director, just done a great job in trying to reorganize things and get these out faster. You know, Ryan Anderson in Northern Region, I got to confess, they know how to deliver projects up there. That's the whole purpose behind CMGC, is make it easier for us to do those. And it's nothing new to the state. Like I said, we've been doing it on the building side for 20 years. Donna?
So why is it being delayed, and who's introducing the bill?
You keep asking these questions I don't have answers to, okay? I don't know why it's being delayed. It's a governor's bill, okay? It's not an individual legislator's bill, and it's got to come out of the governor's legislative office on when they're ready to have it introduced. And like I said, it last crossed our desk, the last few little edits and paperwork that we have to do on those was a week ago.
I think standardizing the process is important, and it would make it more time efficient for the DOT to have that in statute as soon as possible.
Yeah, and I see a benefit on all sides. It'll the public gets the projects quicker. We can shave 3-4 years off a lot of these projects. You know, we get to turn the projects over faster. The contractor is dealing with a project on a negotiated price instead of the who can do it for the least amount of money. You know, the competitive bid process isn't always in the best interest of the public when it comes to getting these projects done and done well. So, update on the Federal FAST Act authorization. That's going. There's a lot of work happening on that in the month of April in Congress. We've been providing some input to both Senator Murkowski's office, Senator Sullivan's, and Congressman Young's office. We've been working, and Ben, we've been working under continuing resolutions. Is that correct?
We've been working on continuing resolutions. We got our full funding when CRISA was allocated back in January, so we're under full apportionment now.
Yeah. And we're good through September, but what we need is the whole bill reauthorized. Interesting things happening in reauthorization from what I've heard, and is that, remember the earmarks that went out about 15 years ago? You know, they said no more earmarks. Well, they're thinking about bringing earmarks back. Only, you know, when they bring them back, there would be some rules associated with them. And again, this is just in the rumor stage, and I rumor is probably not the best word to use, but they're thinking seriously about bringing earmarks back. And in order for an earmark to be in the legislation, it's got to be in our STIP. So the problem we had with earmarks in the past is you'd see a bill show up in one of the reauthorizations. You'd see a project show up, and you never knew where the heck it came from. You know, the right community or what would get to the right member of Congress and talk about getting a project inserted. So you'd see a $30 million project, you know, a project that takes $30 million to construct, and you'd see $3 million in it for Project X. Well, the DOT, whether it's Alaska DOT or other state DOTs, in many cases had no idea what that project was, but it got in there. So the requirement that a project be in the STIP is really a good requirement if you're going to do it. And Andrew?
Yeah, thank you. So you're saying that in order for a project to be earmarked, it has to be on your STIP?
That is what we're hearing. And so, you know, interestingly enough, we got an exit. Go ahead.
Is that coming from the congressional delegation?
Is that coming from who?
Our delegation.
We've heard it from the delegation, and we've heard it from, I've read it in other sources, from ASHTO, American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, and I believe AGC has even talked in some of their publications, talked about earmarks coming back.
Okay, what about those rural projects that never get on the STIP? Just because the process doesn't allow for them to get on into your list here.
There are a lot of rural projects that are on the STIP. You know, and rural projects.
Can you provide that list to us?
The STIP? The list?
The list, yes.
Sure.
Especially the rural projects. Thank you.
Yeah, in fact, you will see here coming up where you're going to get a after I get done with mine and Dan talks a little bit, you're going to have a little presentation on how the STIP works. And along with how the STIP works, what's called AC, or advanced construction, a process we have that goes hand in hand with the STIP and getting our projects on the street. So that's how, yeah, I can't really tell you more on the Federal FAST Act. There are rumors of the, in fact, these rumors have been around for 4 or 5 years about a big infrastructure bill. President Trump talked about it when he was elected and, you know, wasn't able to get any traction on it for 2 years. When the House of Representatives in Washington changed hands to be back under Representative Pelosi, they talked about an infrastructure package and weren't able to get any traction on it. And President Biden is talking about a big infrastructure package. You know, the way they're printing money back in Washington, D.C., who knows what they're going to do. But it's very clear most people that are involved in it is that we have been ignoring our basic infrastructure for quite a while. So, I've got to be optimistic that something will come from it, but there's no guarantee what. And whether it'll be done through the next reauthorization or a separate standalone infrastructure package, I haven't heard rumors one way or the other. And lastly, Andrew wanted to know about the Quinhagak Airport. So Quinhagak Airport, you know, the state previously owned and operated Quinhagak. And in 2004, we built a new airport there. And the city requested, and at the same time, the CDQ thing was coming in, and there was a lot of business activity, fisheries activity in Quinhagak. And at that time, after we rebuilt the airport, the city came to the state and said they wanted to take over ownership and maintenance responsibility of the airport. That doesn't happen very often, and the state's always happy to get rid of assets like that when we can that have responsibilities with them. So those operations and responsibilities were passed over to the city, and we haven't had any involvement in Quinhagak for 15, 16 years since it was turned over to the city. And since then, the airport has degraded. It's in pretty much unsafe conditions. The lighting system is inoperable. Quinhagak's economy wasn't maintained to the level they thought it was going to be maintained, so they weren't able to maintain the airport. And they've approached us about taking the airport back over. And it's not as simple as that because we've got FAA responsibilities in there, and we have to spend money according to their rules. We've got to go through a process to take it over. There was some money in the budget last year to help with that that was vetoed out. But again, we are in the process of going through what the FAA requires us to do in order to take the airport back. And what that means is we have to do a master plan for the airport, one of these bureaucratic things that takes a couple of years to do. And then we put it into the FAA list of getting a project through it and actually bring the airport back up to the standards that it needs. So it doesn't happen overnight, and actually it's not easy anymore to get rid of an airport. It takes a few years to do that. But we are in the process of working with the city of Quinhagak and the FAA to take the airport, take control of the airport again.
Say, John, when they took, oh, this is Tony, when they took over the airport in 2004, were there incentives given to the city for them to take it over? I know that was often true with port facilities. Is that true for this one?
You know, I don't know what incentives were there. I know that a new airport was constructed, you know, new runway, apron, lighting system, and that. It was given to them in brand new condition.
So in the past, when those STIP or when those STIPs are developed, and they have the evaluation boards meeting to score projects, they oftentimes would get additional points. So it sounds likely that willingness to take over the thing probably moved that airport to the top of the STIP.
You know, that might have helped, Tony. But the aviation STIP is a little different than the highway STIP. And, you know, it takes years from inception of a project to actually get it under construction. So I suspect that, you know, this thing, you know, the ball was already moving on this thing to reconstruct the airport before the opportunity to turn it over to the village came in. I don't know for a fact.
Okay, thanks.
So that's all I have on updates. Does anyone have any questions on things that weren't on the list or things that were on the list? Go ahead, Andrew.
Okay, thank you. On the Kunhak Airport, I heard that that airport is currently sinking, and also the access road to it, parts of it are sinking too. So that's information I don't know if you had.
Yeah, that wouldn't surprise me a bit. I know last year when we were talking about it, there were some really tough conditions, and the worst conditions of that airport and many of the airports out there is spring during breakup when the ground's really soft. And it's not unusual for some of those airports to have a week or two period of closure, and I know Quinnahawk is one of those, and you know, the pilots will just not land there because of the poor conditions of the airport. You know, it needs work like some of the others out there do. In fact, we've got a number of airport projects in along the Kuskokwim River that are under construction this year, and over the next 2 years, there's at least another six or eight more that are going to be going to bid to be rebuilt. Yeah, you know what the ground is like out there. It's a lot of permit frost, a lot of unstable soils there, and when you put the embankment on there, it likes to move, and it doesn't all move evenly. It you end up with a roller coaster after a little bit. It's a continuous effort on our part to keep those airports in shape.
Hey, Commissioner, this is Scott Eichold. I have a question. Kind of back to the maintenance of the highways. And this is generated from an observation, personal observation of driving the highways in the northern region and the southern region or south central. I noticed when you get past like probably where their jurisdictional divide is, south of Cantwell, the highways seem to become in better condition. And I would say that's probably due to the crack sealing that they're doing in the south central region that we don't see in the northern region anymore. Just wondering if that's just a plain budget issue or just the difference in the way the maintenance is managed. I mean, we all know what happens to the highways when we let the cracks open. The other thing is the sand aggregate size, northern to southern. And pardon my ignorance on this one, because I just see the highways when I drive on them. But you get to the northern region, they use a much larger aggregate, which obviously causes a lot of damage to vehicles. You get down south to Anchorage, and it's more of a finer sand, and they seem to both work. So I wonder if there's an explanation for that.
You know, Scott, there probably is, and I could only guess, so I'm not going to guess. But I do know that in northern region they use B chips, big chips that have gone through the crusher. They don't, you know, you spread them out, they stay there, they don't roll off. I know in other parts of the state they will use a smaller chip, which tends to be less angular and rolls around a lot more, but it's along the lines more of the sand that you're talking about. I think a lot of it has to do, actually, Jason Sarkalakis, who manages the M&O for all of Northern Region, incredibly bright guy, in sometime in the next couple of weeks, Senate Finance wants a presentation on how we do our maintenance and operation. We do a lot of what's called snow management. It's not snow removal so much as snow management. And I gotta admit that the quality of snow management they do today beats the heck out of what they were doing 15, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. They do an incredible job, and it's, you know, they're putting some science into it. And it's not just spreading sand on the road, it's spreading the right amount of sand in the right spots. And they've got devices that measure how slick the road is when they're traveling along. And that allows them to put some of their stuff. You see them with water tankers out there spreading brine on the road before it even snows. You know, that keeps the snow from sticking to the pavement and allows it to get cleared off. And you end up with more clear pavement in the winter than we used to. We used to end up with packed snow on those roads. And that's why we call it management now. And frankly, they do a tremendous job. And there's a science to it. It's not just all, you know, bulldozing your way through with a plow truck. But when we do have that presentation in Senate Finance, it's really easy to log on and get the presentation. And I'm sure that the people that are putting it together will put together just a bang up job on a great presentation explaining how we do our winter maintenance on the roads in summer. So as far as the crack ceiling goes, it no doubt is a budget issue. But again, Northern Region is subject to different kind of conditions than Central Region or South Coast. And that's one of the reasons you have regional boundaries, because they're different conditions and you deal with them differently. Our biggest problem down here in Southeast is rain. And you know, Northern Region, you get that you know, you get that asphalt, you know, freezing and shrinking up, and so every 150 feet, you got a crack, you know, a horizontal crack, transverse crack across the road.
Yeah, thank you, John. I appreciate that. And that's what, you know, when you notice the most is in the winter when the water does infiltrate and they start to heave, you know, and it just seems, you know, logic would say fill it with tar, but I'm sure there's, you know, a reason. I just, through my observations, I wanted to ask. Thank you.
Yeah, but when that presentation comes, I know Senator Bishop asked for after we gave a presentation on the STIP and AC, a longer version of what you're going to get here shortly. They said they wanted to have one on maintenance and operation. You know, the legislature, especially the Senate, has taken a renewed interest in what DOT does, and it's a constructive interest. You know, we've got friends there and recognize the value of transportation, the value of our roads and highways, and they also recognize that the last few years of budget has not been kind to us, and that's not necessarily in the public's best interest, or not at all in the public's best interest. So, you know, we've got friends there that want to do what's right, and, you know, they understand the construction side, our construction program, and now they want to understand our maintenance side of things, so... When that presentation gets scheduled, I'll make sure that you guys all get notified and how to tune into it and watch it. You know, something for all of us to learn. Okay, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I can turn this back to you. I get to get off my soapbox. This is your remarks, and then we've got those two items that Ben White is there to talk about.
I think you're muted. Dan? I think you're still muted. Are you able to unmute?
You hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know, for some reason our phone put us on mute automatically and they can't make it go off. So I apologize, but Donna had a comment, I think, real quick. I saw her raising her hand there.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. John, have you guys been having discussions about what the impacts are going to be on the Richardson, the Stees, and the Alaska Highway if Ken Ross is going to be hauling from Tok to Fort Knox?
You know, we have. As soon as we learned about that project and the 80 sets of doubles every day, Ryan jumped right into it. And Ryan, you want to talk about that a little bit of your conversation with Ken Ross and somehow turning that stretch of the Richardson into a, for lack of a better phrase, a toll road, more likely an industrial use highway where those trucks are actually paying paying for the use of that road for the extra loads they're putting on it. It's allowed in statute, and it allows them, by conversations early on, it allows them to put that possible cost into their economics. But Ryan, you want to go ahead and talk about that?
Yeah, sure, John. No problem there. Yeah, we've been, late last fall, early this winter. Ken Ross approached us with this concept of hauling. It's basically out there by Tetlin, and then they're going to haul all the way up to Fort Knox to utilize the mill at Fort Knox. They're talking about 80 trucks a day, doubles. They haven't quite worked out configurations, and you know, they're still they're asking us a lot of questions right now. They haven't proposed anything to us, but we've got them in touch with our traffic and safety folks. We've got them in touch with M&O, and you know, we're looking at infrastructure, and you know, everyone's, I think, got a lot of concerns about how well the road can hold up for an operation like that, and then like the commissioner said, industrial use highway regulations have been presented to them as an option. You know, if they do decide to go beyond highway legal loads. So we're in the mix of that one for sure. Kind of the next steps is for Ken Ross to propose to us what their operations are really going to look like.
Yeah, Donna, Ryan's on top of things with that one, and actually quite a few people have expressed concern about what could happen on those roads. And, you know, we've talked about what we could do in advance of anything happening. There's probably a couple of bridges that may not be weak links in it that need to be rebuilt right away, but there's certainly some public safety issues that we could take care of by putting some passing lanes in and pullouts and that get us ahead of the project or get us ahead of the heavy traffic that could occur. And are fairly quick to do. They don't take the, you know, 6-8 years of planning and development for other projects, like other projects do. So Ryan is on top of things on that, and you know, we're trying to stay ahead of that one, and I'm confident that we are. So,
Mr. Chairman, Ryan. Is Ken Ross contemplating hauling heavier than legal loads?
Yeah, they haven't said either way yet, and so that is one thing that I think they're going through that kind of economics on it and how that could work for them. So they really haven't said.
Okay, thank you.
This is Tony. How long would that haul go? For how many years? Do they know yet?
Yeah, what we've been hearing from them is 4 to 5 years.
Who Well, yeah, maybe you ought to figure out where you need some riprap and work a deal with them to backhaul for you. You'd probably get a pretty cheap haul.
Yeah, there's an idea.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, John. I really don't want to spend a lot of time on my remarks or comments, but I really want to kind of focus on how we move forward. It's kind of been a crazy year behind us, and we really haven't been meeting at a regular interval, and I would encourage our group to try to get that part on regularly. As our original charter kind of laid out, we're asked to meet quarterly. I know our charter may be expired, John, or at its end, and we may want to look at getting that put back in statute or a more long-term amendment. If it is so, give us, I guess. And I also would like to invite, welcome Beth Freed as part of our group. She spoke earlier, but she's recently appointed and new to our team, so. Welcome aboard, Beth. I don't really have any other comments. Any questions for me?
Yeah, Dan, I don't know about the charter. I'll have to look into that. I know that the board sunsetted, and it was scheduled to sunset, and before it did, the governor, through Administrative Order 316, continued it. But I'll look into the charter and see if that has a life to it.
Okay, thank you, John. I couldn't find that anywhere, but I guess I didn't look in the right spot.
Yeah.
Dave's is way ahead of me here. Go ahead and ask him.
Yeah, well, this last year has been a weird year, and it's just been about a little over a year since things started to tighten up. And let me tell you something, we're not through it yet. I've had my vaccinations. A lot of the people on this screen have had at least their first, if not their second vaccine. And, listening to Dr. Zink and Dr. McLaughlin yesterday on a hearing, this isn't over next week. I think these masks are still going to be part of life for the next year or two. And COVID's not going away. It's just going to change in form and get a little more common. And like the flu, we're getting used to it. We'll have hopefully, if it does evolve much, it'll get less in impact and less contagious. But this has been something like we've never experienced, and hopefully we'll never experience again. I had actually a couple people came into the building for a meeting today, and let me say it was so refreshing to have a face-to-face meeting. We had a big room, so there was plenty of distancing in there, but these WebEx, these Teams meetings, Zoom meetings, they work, but and there's some really good efficiencies in them, but there's also something lacking in all of them. Get back to the three-dimensional world where you can have a better interaction, a quicker interaction with more people in one room. Call me old-fashioned, but that's I prefer that if we can, and hopefully we can get back into that in the next year or so.
Okay, John, do we want a short break, or do we want to move on and ready to step? I'm getting
it. It'd probably be good to have a short break.
It's 2:10 now, in a sense. Do you want to go 10-minute break and start back at 2:20 if that works for everybody?
10 minutes works.
Okay. So we'll
perfect.
Talk to Ted.
Hey, Dan. I guess I might have missed a meeting or two. I'm not sure, but I would surely like to maybe introduce people that are new, because I'm not sure that I know all the people that are on the committee now.
Tell you what, we'll do that when we get back.
Thanks.